Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. Are you living by the three words that drive evolution? Truth, beauty, and goodness? Well, I expect you are. And we all want to be because that's how evolution will move forward in a way that we are happy with it. And to help move it along is a wonderful book that teaches us, and I've learned a lot from it. It's a beautiful book of expressing ourselves through truth, beauty, and goodness. And it's called The Four Virtues. But wait a second, I just used three words, and this is about four virtues. So this actually talks about how to live in these truths of truth. And his words for them are presence, heart, wisdom, and creation. And through those, he carries us, the author of this great book, The Four Virtues, carries us into a life where we can actually identify our experience and our expression and live more in our virtue. How's that? So to help us be more virtuous is the author of the book, The Four Virtues, Tobin Hart. Tobin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter. Nice to be with you.
I'm so glad that you could join Energy Stew, because I really enjoyed climbing in, chewing on your wisdom and the opportunities to understand how to live deeper in our virtue. And so let's talk about it. Now, how did this come through? What is your background?
Well, I work as a psychology professor at an unusual psychology department, and my interest has been forever where spirituality and psychology come together. And also, having been trained as a therapist and as a teacher, I wonder how those work together, where that interface between spirituality and psychology and education all sort of blend together. So that's part of my background. The book in many ways came out of my own searching. We're all trying to find our way, and me among them, and certainly have gone through times that felt more lost than others. And working for more than 30 years and trying to help others find their way, it occurred to me that there's some things that we know about this already. In fact, we know quite a lot about it, although these things often aren't put together. And one of the things that has not been put together so much is both the psychological and the spiritual, how these things live together. They're sort of odd and paradoxical. You know, the psychological is to develop our will, and the spiritual asks us to be willing. The psychological strengthens our sense of self, and the spiritual asks us to be selfless. So, you know, these things are often conflicting, and it's difficult to sort of tease those out. But this is in part an attempt to try to do just that.
Well, what it is that you make sense of both sides of the coin.
Yeah, I think so. At least for me, they make some sense together, and they do live together. It's just that we often have taken up one side or the other without really forming this balance. And, you know, what we know, we see lots of good examples of people who may be psychologically sort of strong, good ego strength, that kind of thing, but maybe lack a kind of depth and spirituality, and their lives seem a little vacant to themselves at some point. Or, on the other hand, folks that are spiritually adept, but often do kind of dumb things. You know, there's being betrayed by a guru is, almost a cliche these days. So what we know, I think, developmentally is that for every step we take spiritually, we also have to take another step deeper psychologically, and these things really have to work together.
And that's the part of your book, all of your book is about that, but there is a part of wisdom that has to do with truth. And so we can live in truth, but it has to be where we find our wisdom to understand truth better. and you go into that in elaboration, and I really enjoyed it. And I want to go through these steps with you, these virtues, to understand and to flesh them out. And the first is the sense of presence. And presence has to do with our heart and our sense of self, but it's really also, I guess you could put truth in there too, to hold it. But to be present is really important. It's a virtue that not everybody has, and you start off with the virtue of silence.
Yes, this is, and by the way, these things that we're calling virtues, I think of more precisely as inner capacities. You know, these are the capacities or qualities of being, the kind of inner art and inner technology that we can develop. They're not, they're not virtues in the sense of commandments or things that we have to believe in. Instead, they're a way of being, a kind of world presence. Not just a worldview, and as you say, the first one that I talk about in here is presence, and you know, I think if you go, as you're intimating, if you go deep enough in any of these, it opens to all the others. So the deeper
right.
you go in presence,
exactly.
you open to heart or open to wisdom, and so these are trailheads into this depth of humanity and divinity, both I think. And, of course, presence has been getting a lot of nice press in the last 20 years or so. And, you know, mindfulness makes the front cover of Time magazine. And we know about contemplative practice now, and meditation and yoga is almost mainstream in some respects. But what I try to do is just unpack it a bit and talk about the dimensions, these inner capacities. We might, for example, have a great ability to focus our attention. That's one of the qualities of presence. But we may not have as good capacity, for example, to witness our own mind or our own senses or our own emotions as they're happening. And that ability to witness, for example, allows us to both have our anger, for example, and also not be lost to it. So instead of, for example, saying, I'm really pissed off, you know, it might be, I'm really pissed off, and then I still have this capacity to be able to witness and say, well, what's that about? And so this allows us, as Emerson said, actually, to not just be controlled by our mind, but instead to be able to control it.
And in the book, you talk about the Zen beginner's mind. And to say that to ourselves, can I come from a beginner's mind about this? Or am I already too jaded to be able to see this with clarity?
Yeah, part of the things we learn across all of the wisdom traditions, and that's where I'm trying to draw from neuroscience to the Greeks to contemporary mystics and really across all the religions, is this notion that we can, Peter? I wasn't very present there. I just lost my train of thought. Sorry about that.
Well, you were in a beginner's mind.
Exactly. There you go. Okay. Thanks.
And that's a benefit. So let's not be upset about it. And
well,
we have to forgive ourselves. I learned that a long time ago. Speaking to an audience, I lost my train of thought in front of about 200 people, and I just said, excuse me, I have to take a moment of silence to recover my mind. And then afterwards I was beating myself up about it, and then I said, but wait a minute, they're all human too. We really need to accept the fact that, you know, we do have these moments, and we should really honor them and have compassion for it.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And it's helpful when you're when your partner here is kind as well, isn't it? So, yeah, it's about owning it and forgiving it, and that's certainly part of that. That beginner's mind, of course, is what, in many ways, we're really trained out of when we go to school. We're trained to know things. We're tested on what we know, and in this world, we've got to flip our finger if we don't know. That is, flip our finger on our keypad or our phone in order to get information. And what beginner's mind does is allow us to see the thing in front of us as if for the first time. So it's a radical openness that allows us to actually enter into the thing. And this is, in many ways, the key, or one of the keys, at least, to presence, because when we allow ourselves to really be with the other, whether it's a person or a tree or our own experiences, it opens what I think the Greeks were looking at as the beautiful. That is, beauty reveals itself to the extent that we open to it.
And truth also, because, absolutely, for instance, I work as an intuitive, and I'll sit down with people, and I don't want my mind to know anything. I want to be in total beginner's mind. I want to be in a blank state of just being present. And then stories and information start flooding into my mind. And all it is information about the person I'm sitting in front of, because I have nothing else going on. I'm not looking for any other thing. I'm not trying to figure anything out. And it's an amazingly open experience that allows it to be true. And people are amazed at what comes through when I have no thought consciousness pushing me, trying to be smart or trying to figure anything out.
Yeah, it's a great description of it, and it describes beautifully, I think, these two modes that we have. One is this working off of our categories of understanding. Oh, you must be this, or I need to, I have this agenda. And then this other one is this, again, this beginner's mind, this radical openness. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's an innocence that people don't understand, because, you talk about this later on in the book, where there's even that you have to live in betrayal, actually, betrayal of the norm, and of what people expect, and not be caught into trying to be right.
Yeah, this notion of needing to betray another in order to be true to ourselves, this sounds like heresy in terms of loyalty. But so much of what this is about is trying to do exactly that. That is, to be true to the depths of ourself. In order to be true to that, we have to be in it. We have to know what's going on in there. And so this notion of presence and so forth is as part of what allows us to really dig down deep and then in turn meet the world in front of us from this deep place. I really see this as about deep to deep. And this is part of what we're missing in the culture a lot these days, I think, because of the kind of hyperdrive we're in and the remarkable sort of access to information and one another. Linda Stone, a former IBM and Microsoft, or rather IBM and Apple executive, called this continuous partial attention. That part of the disease that we have now as living as virtual live electronic nodes on the information superhighway is that we're always on the lookout for the next thing, always ready to respond to the next thing rather than being where we are, rather than being in the now, in the moment, and going deep. And so this kind of skims across the surface of our experience and our life in many ways, rather than digging deep into those places that really nourish us and nourish the world.
And what helps is a lot in your book about how to live with wisdom. You know, there's truth, right? Truth is great. But how wise is it all the time? It can be a truth that can be very harmful. It can be a truth that can be very transitory. Truths can change a lot. from one moment to the next when we learn new information, times change, truths change. But wisdom is a larger picture. And that's something that I was very glad to read about and to see how you define wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like Aquinas' definition of wisdom. He says, wisdom involves nome, and nome means seeing from a greater height or seeing into the heart of something. And this, to me, describes not wisdom as an entity. It's not that we accumulate wisdom. It's instead that we act wisely. And so it's a process rather than an entity, essentially, an acquisition. And so it requires certain qualities in order for us to be awake to this moment, to see what's called for. Martin Luther King said that wisdom is a blend of what's true with what's right. And so somehow wisdom always takes into account the heart, we might say, values and virtue of a particular quality, the concern for others or the greater good, as well as what is called for in this moment. And so it's this very active process, and this is why sometimes little kids can be, say the wisest things or ask those most profound questions, and other times, the most intelligent adults do kind of dumb things.
So. Right, because kids haven't learned to shield their hearts as much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's so much in your book about the heart. It's a major part of your book is how to experience and find your heart and connect with the hearts of others as well. And it's because there's a community of heart as well as our own heart.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how best to utilize our hearts in our lives. And that is part of those three words that brought all this on, truth, beauty, and goodness. And the goodness part, to me, is the ultimate of the heart part.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we know this, the heart or love or compassion is throughout all the wisdom traditions is both the path and the end goal of a life well lived. And so this is so essential, but often, more words and more movies and more songs have been written about love than anything else, and yet we don't necessarily have a good way of understanding this fully. We can get a sense of our passion sometimes, but it's a little tricky, I think. And so I try unsuccessfully to do the impossible, and that is to try to unpack and even operationalize the notion of love. But what I do try to talk about is that the heart is essentially the source of what the Greeks would talk about as the good, and that the heart involves certain things. It involves compassion, it involves empathy, it involves feeling, and it involves a recognition that we, from birth, are hardwired to connect with each other. We're social beings. And, in fact, a whole new field of social neuroscience has come along to help us understand that there is even a physiological, anatomical substrate to our need for connection.
And you talk about somebody who worked as in ministry to death row inmates and found the goodness in them.
This was a lovely guy who came back to school many years later. He was doing a master's degree in psychology in the program where I worked, and he also had a ministry in the Deep South. He went and visited death row inmates on a weekly basis. And he would go in and he would try to imagine what their lives were like. And there was really no doubt that these folks had committed these horrific crimes, and always a tattered life's tale poured out. But what became most remarkable to this man is that he found himself, after weeks and weeks of being with folks, finally sort of stopping wondering about the details of their life, wondering about how this happened, how this could have happened, and instead simply met the person. He wasn't trying to sell them anything, not even religion at this point. He was simply trying to meet them and be with them. And when he did, when he really came into that empathic connection, that compassionate, loving space, heart space with them, he said, certainly this tale poured out. But what happened is, he said, I saw something else in them. And he said, I saw this spark of divinity, this spark of humanity. And he said, he wanted to make clear that this was not what he was, even though this was what he was supposed to say as a minister, this wasn't what he was experiencing. It was instead a direct connection of heart-to-heart love. And he said, I fell in love with these guys. I just love them because we met in a place that was beyond all of the history and instead simply met at the level of humanity. And he said that it brought them to life as well, too.
And I experienced that myself. I used to volunteer at a maximum security prison. And the inmates there were so wonderful. They had all done terrible things, I presume. I didn't know any of their stories. I just knew that connecting with them, they expressed incredible heart and connection, and it was amazing. I don't want to speak about their public lives because privately between souls, they knew how to connect, and it felt really good. And I have very close friends who have a ministry in maximum security prisons. We talk about that, and it's amazing what humanity not only you can find, but you can develop more and more of. And many people, when they get out of prison, can become really good citizens if you help them find their own hearts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, part of the issue is a lot of times with heart is that sometimes folks will have access to their heart. They have a big heart, but not always have great balance or great discernment or great ability to sort of modulate their passion and so forth. And part of what this book is about for me is recognizing that these things require one another. For example, someone with great heart but not wisdom may pour their heart out in a way that burns themselves out. Someone who has a great sense of stillness and quiet, but no outlet, no creative outlet, our last virtue, this creation, may find themselves sort of backing up, their consciousness sort of backing up because they've got this incredible big view and big vision, but don't necessarily have any way to express it.
And also, you talk about the need for joy in our lives, and you can be very truthful and wise and do good, but don't know how to really be joyful. There's so many well-meaning people out there that are just too serious.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of martyr complexes. I mean, sometimes when you've got a really big heart and you want to serve and you see the suffering of the world, it's hard to find the place where the joy is in the middle of that. And yet, I love this one line. It's not mine, but it's the place that we're looking for is the place where our deep gladness meets the world's great need. This isn't happiness, but this is joy. This is a kind of ability to really find the place where we can pour ourselves out into.
Right, and often you can come from suffering, adversity, and you talk about marathons in the book, and how many people would run a marathon if there wasn't adversity to it? And yet it's the finish of the marathon that brings the greatest joy, even though it is joyful to watch ourselves improve as we train for a marathon, but crossing that finish line is amazing, but it only comes from hard work.
Yeah, some folks suggest that suffering is the first grace. This seems crazy, right? I mean, in a climate that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is what we're about, and you know, we have opportunities for every possible indulgence in this world now, and yet suffering is that thing that so many of the traditions recognize not only as sort of clearing us out, but really prioritizing what's important and what's not. And it helps us sort of get beyond ourselves in some way in order to find what really matters and to feel the depth of our range. You know, it's very difficult to feel joy unless you've felt suffering as well.
Right. And so there's so much in your book that has to do with wisdom and truth, and we're just, that's what this is all about. And to bring us back to ways to improve our lives, there's so many helpful exercises in your book about utilizing these understandings that you provide. And it's a very helpful book to climb into the mechanisms of the unfoldment of these great truths, these great virtues, and to use them, utilize them, learn how to be virtuous in our lives. And so I want to thank you for that too, because it's an opportunity, to name the book The Four Virtues is very nice, and people go, oh good, you know, yet they don't realize that this is an education in your book about how to be virtuous, not just let's just talk about it.
Yeah, that's a nice way to say it. It was intended to be both inspiring, hopefully, but also really down to earth. I mean, how do you do this? And certainly there are wonderful exercises out in the world these days and practices and guidance. And so in this, in addition to the ideas, there are, at the end of each of these 16 chapters or so, specific exercises that are geared, for example, towards empathy or towards guidance or towards discerning, this kind of thing. And at the beginning of the chapters, there's also a little quiz that's just a little self-scoring quiz that helps us just get a handle on where our strengths might be, these enduring qualities that we've really got down and can rely on, but also these places where there may be trailheads, these aspects that may not be as strong and therefore sometimes cause us some difficulty or at least some opportunities for growth.
Well, after you focus on presence, heart, and wisdom, you tackle creation. Now, that's the opportunity here, is because of all the work previous to that, to come to that last part of the book where we can actually learn how to create from these great strengths.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, this last piece is really about finding our voice. And by voice, I mean our unique creative expression in the world. And this good, true, beautiful is then balanced and made manifest with voice or creation. That our job is to bring ourselves in our particularly unique and original and imaginative way into the world. And of course, it doesn't mean just about the artist or the great discoverer or inventor, but it means the way that we live our life each day, the way that we are ultimately responsible for the quality of our love or joy what we do day in and day out with our family or our loved ones or our workers.
Well, we have to wind up the show, and that's a great way to understand how we can fulfill a virtuous life. And so, Tobin Hart, I want to thank you so much for writing this book and for being a guest on Energy Stew. It's really wonderful talking with you.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Sure. And this is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew at prn.fm. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you. There are a lot of classes I'm teaching online. So wherever you live, you can join in. And thank you so much for listening.